you, Mary and Carol. That was fabulous. Good morning and welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universal Society. My name is Christina Clack and I'll be your presider today. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and an open-minded congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. We welcome you no matter what your age or your abilities or your inabilities. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services. They are presented either by a Prairie member, a member of the wider community, or by Reverend Sandy Ingham. Today, we are delighted to have Reverend John Mix with us to talk about art, justice, and jail ministry. Our opening words today will be presented by Rick Recking.
From an anonymous Wisconsin Circuit Court judge. Alternatives to incarceration save money and save lives. It's much cheaper to treat people than to lock them up, and you have better outcomes. There's less recidivism, fewer victims, and less use of the justice system. You end up with contributors to society and all of the benefits of that.
Kate Lou and her family will provide our chalice lighting today.
Okay, excellent. I guess I'm going to stand here while I'm
dressing. We light this chalice to celebrate the inherent worth and dignity of every person, to reaffirm the historic pledge of liberal religion to seek justice which transcends mere legality and moves towards the resolution of true equality, and to share that love which is ultimately beyond even our cherished reason, that love which unites us. Steve, stop.
Now we invite children and parents to the front of the room for our children's story, which will be shared today by Reverend John Mix.
Good to see you. Do you guys like a story? Yeah? Do you like a story? I like stories. And I expect I could tell a lot of stories. In fact, that's the way people learned from each other. I'm actually not going to read a story this morning. I'm just going to tell you a little bit of a story, okay? How many of you are in school? You go to school during the day, okay? Yeah, lots of you. Do you know that's really important to do? Yeah. And we learn a lot, right? Years and years ago, they didn't go to school. They didn't have much in school. In fact, not many people would even read. If you'd go maybe back 1,000 years or so, most people wouldn't be able to read this. You know, they wouldn't know what these marks on here say. But you're in school, right? And, huh? And you learn how to read. Excellent. You're reading my mind. That's good. And, huh?
My mom is next to my school.
Is she? Yeah, that's awesome.
And my dad.
And your dad, too. Boy, that's just so good. I just want you to know how beautiful it is to be able to read and to learn to read. As I say, years and years and years ago, people didn't do that very much. They relied on other people to read. You know, maybe the minister in the town would read, and maybe the doctor in town, they'd know how to read. Well, I work in a place called our county jail. And if a person does something wrong in Madison area, it's wrong and they get arrested, and the policeman or the sheriff comes there and brings them downtown to the jail. And they have to stay there for a while. And I just tell you about a fellow who I met down there who was in the jail. He was locked up. And we were sitting at the table in the jail, and he told me that he sold drugs to support his three kids. And then he kind of said in a hushed tone of voice, kind of quietly, he said, "But I can only read at the third grade reading level." Now, having three kids growing in school, he knew that his kids pretty soon would be able to read better than he could. He was 25, he was a dad. And a tear came down his cheek when he told me that he could only read at that level. And I said, "Would you work with somebody? Would you like some help with that? And if we had somebody come in to this jail to help you learn to read?" And he said, "Yeah, I would." Well, that day, I said, "We are going to get some volunteers to help us, you know, come into the jail to help people like this who need to learn better how to read, you know?" So, just to give you a little bit of the end of the story, I found out later from a teacher, he got in touch with a teacher in the jail. And the teacher told me, she said, "JJ shouldn't have been kept in the special ed class that he was in school when he was a kid. He was in there to get some help, but he stayed there, and he never got out of that special class. And he could have been taken, you know, moved up into a higher level of his abilities." So, in other words, he didn't get all the help he needed to get. And so he became a dad, and then, wow, he just didn't know how to help his kids, and he got in trouble. So I just want you to number one, be thankful that you are learning how to read and that people read you stories. It's fun, it's exciting, and you know what? Here's some of the greatest beauty of this is that you get to discover what you can do in this world, you know? Because if you learn to read, everything is open to you. You can learn what you want to learn. You can follow. Tell me some things that you're excited about, that you like to You like your grandma's house? Yeah, yeah. There's good things happen at grandma's. Anything? What are some things that you like to do or play with? Yeah, yeah. And she, for those who didn't hear, you like to go in your grandma's rocking chair, and sometimes your grandma's in that rocking chair, and she'll tell you a story, huh? Yeah, read you a story. Okay. Well, I just thank you for coming up, and for the gift that you are. You just remember, okay, that you are an awesome, beautiful gift to this world. And reading is going to help you become all that you want to become over time, okay? Thanks for coming up.
I'm very pleased this morning to be able to introduce our guest speaker. Reverend John Mix discovered his calling as an artist after serving Lutheran churches as a pastor. His study of creation spirituality with Matthew Fox in 1982 to 83 enlightened the connections between art, spirituality, and social justice. As a freelance artist from 1986 to 2006, he discovered prison ministry part-time and became certified as an ATIRA, is that how you, ATIRA process teacher, that's very similar to art therapy. Since 2007, Reverend John Mix continues to paint landscapes and portraits in oil and pastel, and has the support of area churches to be a full-time chaplain at the Dane County Jail. He also facilitates weekly expressive art sessions at the Tellurian Addiction Treatment Center. Welcome.
Thank you for the opportunity to be with you and to share some of the work that I do and some of the work that we share together. It was a joy to know that Prairie Unitarian became part of the Moses organization that celebrates a year in existence this very month, actually last night. I will share some of the work that I'm involved in, and just FYI, if there's more that you would like to know about our jail ministry, the website madisonjailministry.org would get you our website about the work that we do there, and Chaplain Julia and I blog on occasion our experiences, and they are on that website too, madisonjailministry.org. My journey as a minister, as an artist, is different than most. I didn't realize the art was a part of me as deep as it was until I got into the ministry. Never thought about taking an art class in all those years of college and seminary. But when I got to my first parish in a little town in Iowa, I met a Presbyterian pastor who had an acrylic painting hobby. And it went click. Oh, I want that. You know, and you know, you're in a parish and you're starting to raise a family, and went to Minnesota and met another pastor who is an accomplished watercolor painter, and I thought, man, I really want that, you know. And that's part of what led to the occasion of hearing Matthew Fox speak on the connections between art and spirituality and social justice, as that was the program that he started and offered. It was a master's study of 9 months in Chicago at that time, back in the early 80s. And so when I enrolled in that, we moved the family to Chicago, took on this program. The first art class I ever had was painting as meditation. And a Catholic nun, Blanche Gallagher, a watercolor artist, taught this class. And it was all about discovering the wisdom, both of in the gifts of the mystics, Teresa of Avila, Meister Eckhart, etc., and some of their contributions to where we are, what this world is, and how deep the beauty is. And it was all a process discovery. It wasn't a how-to in watercolor. It was about using watercolor to be a channel of discovery and interaction with your own life and the earth. So one more time in parish ministry after that, but it was the administrative management part of parish ministry that's just kind of tore me down. And there wasn't enough of the pastoral care and the counseling, which is what I really like to do. So I left parish ministry in 86, and I said, that's it, I've got to pursue the art. And the previous generation ahead of me, would have said, if you've got a good job, you keep it, you know, and then when you retire, you can do what you want to do, you know. Well, that wasn't going to work for me. That wasn't going to fly, because My father died of cancer at the age of 52. He's a farmer in Minnesota, and I was just 6 weeks old. And so, my experience was, not everyone makes it to that proverbial retirement and has that option then. Got to go now. And so at the age of 35, I enrolled in Drawing 101, and I knew I'd come home to a part of myself that had been asleep and yearning for discovery. And so the depression that I experienced in parish ministry was a nudge of God and the universe to say, something's not there, something's missing. So one of the things that I struggled with in that transition was the sense of calling. If you feel called to a certain work, you can be called out of it, and you can be called to something else. And I just want to share a definition of vocation that I found just extremely helpful. And Frederick Buechner is an author, theologian, who says, vocation is that place to which God calls you, where your deepest gladness and the world's hunger meet. You love to do it, is the way I paraphrase it, and the world needs to have it done. Where is that intersection? You love to do it, and the world needs to have it done. Well, those things that we truly enjoy, our deepest gladness, it's in there, it's in us for a reason. And so we, at our own peril, ignore those callings and those yearnings. So it's been very healing for me, personally, just to embrace the artist within and to get on with it. And but it was down that road of pursuing art that I discovered prison ministry part-time. I was in a setting similar to this, and the speaker was speaking on prison ministry. And I was in where you're sitting, and I heard that. And I said to him afterwards, I'm kind of curious, what's that about? And he says, well, let's have breakfast. And pretty soon, I was going one day a week to a medium security prison an hour west of the Chicago suburbs where I was raising my family. So that's how the connection got woven in me. I didn't know in 1982 when I was in Matt Fox's program in Creation Spirituality that art and spirituality and social justice would show up in my body as, I've got to pursue art and then discover prison ministry, and that whole connection came together in me. So I was giving a talk like this to a congregation some years ago, and talking to a woman afterwards, I said, it's really kind of odd that I've got into this kind of work. I've never been arrested. I've never had a drug and alcohol problem. She tapped me on the shoulder and said, it's never too late. So let's hear it for a little humility, right at the start. But just to give you a bit of a snapshot of my work in the jail, as a chaplain, the real essence of the work is I put in three different things. Number one is presence. It's a ministry of presence. Jail, by definition, just cuts people off from the community, restricts access to them. And so I give thanks that for 40 years, churches in Dane County have said, we want to have someone inside and be there with them when they are cut off from us. And so my discovery that I really like that kind of work was a way of saying, this is this is what I what I'm part of what I'm cut out to do. And being present means just where people are at. You know, religion or no religion, that's just not the issue. It's to be there, to listen, and that's the second thing. Present listening is the second. I hear what they want to share, and that is healing, actually. People can request, what I'm doing is answering people's requests to see me. You know, they'll send a little request slip and they'll say, you know, can you come and talk to me? I need a Bible or a Quran or some other spiritual material. I bring them whatever they ask for, if we have it. And most of the materials are all donated. And and that's the part of the thing about chaplaincy that I appreciate, that it's interfaith, it's respecting everybody's place, no matter where they are in this life journey. And the third thing beyond presence and prayer and listening is prayer. Quite often they'll ask for or definitely say yes when I ask them. I'm willing to share a prayer if you'd like. And very often they accept that. I'll never forget the woman I saw who, as an addict, had to bear the news that her daughter overdosed while she was there in jail. And she was able to keep a rational way, just spoke in a level tone more or less as she shared what was going on, but it was in the prayer that she just plain broke down and cried through the entire prayer. So nothing will really replace being there for someone who is in misery. You and I know that about ourselves, and I just want to lift that up to you as a faith community, as a gathering community. Celebrate, give thanks for the gift that you are to each other. Because you know that if you experience a loss in your life, setback, you have shoulders you can rely on, lean on, cry on here. I want to tell you that is a experience that almost no one in our county jail has had. When people share some of the life experiences that they do, and I'll give you a couple examples, sometimes I'll ask them, have you ever shared this with someone before? And I virtually never hear yes. So that is one thing I would invite you to remember. If you forget everything else I said today, the underground river underneath the entire criminal justice system, in my opinion, is unresolved grief. Unresolved grief. So much loss, so much abandonment, so much abuse and violence that has never been spoken of in a place of safety and care. That I hear that and see that continually and consistently. So just a snapshot in terms of the jail itself, we're talking 900 of our neighbors on any given day there. About 750 women, men rather, and about 150 women. And by the way, Chaplain Julia Weaver, ordained UCC minister, is my coworker. So there, she sees the women there, and I work full-time with the men. I asked the mental health director one day, said, you know, about how many people would you say in this jail are seriously mentally ill? And she said, about a quarter to a third. So think 250 to 300 people who depend on medication, you know, to modify their symptoms. Clearly, 80% of the reason people are showing up in jail has some connection to addiction. Using, selling, got into arguments because of that, drinking, drunk driving, you name it. That's in the picture on that to that significant degree. I was going by a cell block one day, and I won't use his real name, but Robert said to me, "Chaplain, I'm a failure." And I knew when I heard that that we've got to talk one-on-one. I mean, he was in a cell block with, you know, six other guys, and he's 52. He'd been in and out of the prisons and jail for most of his adult life. And so I said, "Would you be willing to, you know, talk with me one-on-one? Just have the deputy let him out." And he did, and we did. So in confidence, in one-on-one, some privacy, I said, "Robert, where did he get started with the alcohol?" Because that was what his struggle was as an alcoholic. He said, "I was 16, and my brother and I were really close. He was 3 years older than me at 19, and he said my brother went on a canoe trip and drowned." And I said, "Could you talk about your feelings of sadness and anger and loss as a family?" No. And when that happened, and he said, "No, we couldn't talk about those kind of feelings as a family." And so within a year, you know, he turned to alcohol. And it wasn't too much longer after that, of course, that it became full-blown alcoholism. And so I said to him, "So Robert, would you be willing to write a letter to your brother and just put down on a piece of paper, you know, every feeling that you've got about your brother? I mean, this, your anger, sadness, bitterness, whatever it is, just write it in a letter. And just keep writing until you've said all you want to say." And he says, "Yeah, I suppose I could." So a few days later, I came by his cell block, and he said, "Chaplain, I wrote that letter." And so I said to him, "If you're willing to share it, I'm willing to hear it." So we went in that room again, the two of us, and he sat down and read. He had 3 pages written just of how he felt about that loss. And it was like hearing this death happen 3 weeks ago. You know, it was just still that raw. And he'd been in treatment before, but somehow they apparently had not tapped this or gotten to this space. And there was a significant shift in Robert after that. Granted, it's only a beginning. It's a small thing, but there is nothing that replaces, in my view, confidence, safety, listening, sharing what's real, you know, at the moment, your experience of the moment. And sometimes we'll use art media, you know, in getting to that type of spot. My training is to use simple materials, like pastels, oil pastels, crayons, markers, anything, whatever's simple, and just let them express visually what the experience of this moment is. And then once that's made, and of course there's absolutely no judgment whatsoever, there's no wrong, there's just this expression of what is the moment. And again, it's a creating a safety and a listening for that. And the if there are times when sometimes you don't even know what you feel because it's so overwhelming. And given time and given a little space like that, there is opportunity to enter in to the experience and be present to that moment. I mean, that's the essence of it. Tom was a young fellow, 22. That's not, again, not his real name. But at 17, under the influence of marijuana, his car wandered across the center line and collided with another car, and a man in the oncoming car was killed. He got drug court after that because he was so young, and nearly completed it but failed. And the state sentence then came into play, and so now he's up at Dodge. His father was ailing when he left here and died after he went to prison. And so since he and I had worked closely together, Tom was an excellent artist. I mean, the guy could just, he drew portraits all night long of his family, and huge and beautiful. And he's still doing it up at prison. He wrote to me. But one of the different outcomes that I wouldn't have guessed could happen for him was that he is now volunteering in the prison up at Dodge, at Waupun, in the hospice program in the prison. So, and he sent me a small sketch. I wish I would have remembered to grab it from my office. A little sketch he had done, a portrait sketch of this man that he had been sitting with in hospice in prison. So I see in him, you know, he knows that he's got to recover from this burden of realizing that his lapse in judgment cost the life of another person. But I see him plowing that energy into art, into, you know, caring for another through hospice. And so when that's occurring, there's hope, you know, there really is, because not one of us can change one thing about the past. You know, it's absolutely gone. But we can change our relationship to that past. And that's where forgiveness comes in, that's where listening comes in, that's where healing and embracing this moment comes in. I'd like for people to be able to answer, I'd be happy to answer questions, and I know I could go on and on, but it's good that you put a clock back there, because I would not be able to be honest. Again, I'm thankful that you have chosen to be a part of MOSES. I helped to form that organization. When I, given my experience, I said, man, we have got to work with our legislature and this system we have in Wisconsin, because, you know, besides the huge numbers of 22,000, give or take, in our prisons, we have so much to learn from our neighbor in Minnesota. They have less than half of that in their prison. Same population, basically, you know, same, similar demographics. But, you know, we spend $1.3 billion on Department of Corrections. They're in Minnesota, it's about $500 million. So less than half. It's because they have more treatment. You know, they've been on that for years, and they, you know, doing well with it. I'm sorry that we only could get our legislature this year to up the money designated for treatment up to $3 million from $1 million, but it's a paltry piddling, in my honest opinion. but it's in the right direction at least, and we've got more work to do as, you know, as people. So let's take a few questions. Question about how I confront the alcoholism when I see it or hear it. A couple of standard questions. If they're young, number one, ask them if they've finished school. And I hear no way often more than I hear yes. And just a little footnote, 75% of people in jail in the United States did not finish high school. You know, so that tells us a lot. But as to the alcoholism, I definitely ask him if he ever considered treatment. And in our conversation, I can usually tell pretty soon how much pain they're in about it, you know, and what kind of yearning there is for an alternative. You know, where's life, where's the good stuff? And also parenthetically, when I see people coming back, you know, I've seen them before and they're back again, I'll say, did you reach out to AA, NA, the church group, support group, anything? Too often I hear, no, I thought I could do it myself, you know? And that just points to me to a fundamental fabric of the way this universe is put together, that we are made to connect. You know, you and I, you know, we're not made to do this life just a solo hermit, you know, off in the, you know, the distance. We need each other. And so someone who's struggling with addiction, if they can say when they've got those using thoughts, you know, boy, I got to call somebody, I got to talk to somebody, then you know there's going to be a difference. There's going to be some help, you know. But then the other question part was about the art therapy process. You know, if I direct that some way or let them, in terms of the subject or, yeah. First of all, for most people, they're not used to, as adults, having some crayons or something. You know, so there's this little intimidation factor for some, for many, you know. Because as adults, we've all learned that, you know, I should do it right and all that. And so part of the initial thing, and by the way, I'd love to, you know, do an exercise with y'all some other time, where we just invite that sense of letting go and welcoming, and it's okay no matter what goes down there. Just for some, I can get the a sense of them pretty easily in terms of how ready or willing they are to just take a hold of. Because if they just jump in and start moving and start making, I won't interrupt that. I'll just just let it go, and whatever goes down there, it's gonna be fine. You know, there's just no judgment. So, but if they are, you know, reluctant or, you know, fearful, I'll just sometimes give them a topic, like, you know, if you could go any place, you know, in the whole world, just you could be there in an instant. No money's no problem. Where would you go, you know, and just let the imagination run with that, you know. And so I have some kind of standard topic questions like that, that what's your earliest memory, you know. Never forget, I was with a group in prison, in the treatment center in prison in Illinois before I came up here 11 years ago. I said, what's your earliest memory? There's 30 guys in this day room, and a guy came up to me with his paper, and he had drawn a rectangle on the paper, and he put a jagged line through there, and he had this stick figure standing next to that rectangle, and he wrote at the bottom, when my dad broke out all the windows in the house. And I said, how old were you when that happened? And he said, 6. He said, Grandma and I, you know, ran upstairs and hid in the closet. So here, how old are you now? He's 26. I said, in all these years, you know, it's been 20 years, have you thought about that memory of your dad being in an alcoholic rage? And he said, no, until you asked that question, I really hadn't thought about it. So just that little piece becomes this bridge to this, you know, experience of fear that's been running his life for all this time, and the lack of security, and now being in treatment for the same thing that, you know, his father had struggled with. So the education in particularly mental health type of treatment available in the jail. We have certainly a mental health staff that's 24/7, where there's at least one person overnight, you know, in the jail from that department. And truthfully, I mean, they're a great team, and their office is right next door to the chaplain's office, which I appreciate, and so we can interact on various people. If there's somebody who needs a follow-up from one or the other, you know, that's good. But essentially what is happening with the mental health staff, though, is they are monitoring, you know, meds, and they're that contact with, because we have medical staff as well. There are nurses who distribute meds, but mental health staff is more or less keeping a monitoring of how that's working and going. But honestly, they don't have enough people to sit down and do any kind of counseling as far as that part. So you're looking at the one, you know, Julia and I are the ones who could sit down for an hour or 45 minutes with somebody and just really have one-on-one time. As to education, MATC has had a successful GED program in the jail for quite a number of years, and it's always, you know, more or less full. There were rotation of teachers that come in. And also, two Madison area school district teachers are in the jail full time. I mean, they each in each building downtown, city county building and the public safety building. So kids, people under 18 and under, you know, can continue whatever high school and could potentially finish. And I'm always happy to go to a graduation when one does complete. Yeah, just, I don't know how much people have been informed about the focus of MOSES since prior to the budget being passed in the summer. It was all about increase the money that we spend in Wisconsin for treatment, because if we do a dollar we spend on treatment saves Wisconsin $2 in avoided crime and avoided incarceration. I mean, it's documented proof. Hard data, you know, and the committee that found that result said that's even the most conservative estimate of the savings. It's quite likely even more, you know, but there's other soft results that are hard to measure and so forth. But it was sad to see them only go up to $3 million for the next biennium. Since the budget was passed, then the 11 by 15 campaign had to shift gears and say, well, now the treatment money is designated, that's over, we got to move, what's next? And so it's about sentence reform, it's about reentry issues, when people are coming back to our community, how do they, you know, reintegrate? And so back to this, you know, business about the education and the jobs, you know. There's just so much to say about people embracing the value of taking a hold of education and saying, what skills do I need? I might just add that we have, Julia and I run what we call a beginnings program. Bethel Lutheran Church, not far off the square, offers us space to meet with Huber inmates. She meets with the women on Tuesday, I meet with the men on Wednesday, and in that beginnings group, we have 2 hours in the afternoon every Wednesday to look at reentry issues for people in that are going to be out of jail in 2, 3, 4 months. And one of the beauties of that program is that we get to bring community resource people there to the church, whereas they would not as easily be able to come into the jail to talk with them. And so people who are can put them in touch with apprenticeship programs and other job training programs that exist. YWCA here in Madison has a couple of good programs that help people get entry-level jobs, you know, trades, building and road construction, etc. So that program is one way to help them get the information that might, for those who are motivated, you know, that's key, obviously. So we would do better to invest the money in treatment and education than to the ridiculous war on drugs. Is, I don't know anybody who says that's a success. It's an absolute failure. So thank you for your attention and your work and our partnership in this community to keep moving forward. So thank you.
Our closing words: addiction should never be treated as a crime. It has to be treated as a health problem. We do not send alcoholics to jail in this country. Over 500,000 people are in our jails who are nonviolent drug users. Ralph Nader.
Before we extinguish the chalice this morning, I did want to mention that the pieces of art that you see up here are John's artwork. They're very beautiful. So in your program, could we speak in unison the extinguishing the chalice words, please? We extinguish this flame, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we carry in our hearts until we are together again. Please stay for conversation and coffee, and thank you for coming this morning.